Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, welcome. I'm Dr. Peter Zafiridis, and this is the Healthy Mind Podcast. Here, we talk about our emotional health and well-being, about living the most authentic life we possibly can, the one we truly deserve. So take notice, our true strength and action are on the march, while our fears and self-doubt are on the run. Never doubt how truly powerful you are. Let's learn together, right here on The Healthy Mind. All right, well, welcome, ladies and gentlemen, welcome. I'm Dr. Peter Zafiridis, and this is The Healthy Mind Podcast. Thank you so much for taking time out of your day to listen to the program. I apologize for last week's, I guess, non-podcast. I got hammered with a stomach flu. It was amazing. And I have to tell you, it took a few days to get better from that. So thank you for bearing with me. But I'm back. I am ready. And I have a great, great podcast for you today. We are going to be talking about something that is probably near and dear to everyone. Family conflict. We've all been there, right? Family conflict. Why we argue with each other so much, especially our family members. You know, there's that old quote, we always hurt the ones we love. And it really is true. And today we're going to talk about the origin of that, why that happens, why it seems that we can unleash so much of our emotion, negative emotion, sadness, irritability, anger, rage, and in unfortunate cases, violence. Why that happens, why families are so vulnerable. And I think you're going to be surprised at part of the reason. So we'll talk about that and maybe ways that if we're aware of some of the vulnerabilities that exist, especially as we lower our defenses with family members, maybe it can make that family conflict less, or we can build coping skills to minimize the amount of family conflict in our lives. So family conflict this week on The Healthy Mind. Now, you're going to want to stick around for the second half of the podcast. Some really fascinating health news. A new study has looked at depression and the possibility that it can be contagious. Oh, yes, contagious. That there's a contagion to our mood. And not just immediately in terms of, well, yeah, it makes sense, Peter, that if someone's in a bad mood or down, I'm going to feel bad. Oh, no, no. That's not the kind of news I bring you here at The Healthy Mind. Not at all. Researchers have found that this contagion effect can linger and echo and last for a much longer time than was previously ever imagined. You are really going to be stunned by these results. Also, a new study, beautiful, beautiful new study on omega-3 fatty acids and the effect that they have on memory. More good stuff about omega-3s. You know we talk about that a lot here on The Healthy Mind. The website, as always, www.thehealthymind.com. You can also find us on iTunes. Man, I've got a good show for you. We're going to do headlines, and hey, we've got ourselves a heck of a podcast. So, are you ready? Let's begin. Okay. Now, family conflict. Gosh, it is something that comes at least through my doors so often. And I ask you to think about maybe your own family situations. Maybe you've been involved in it or have received the wrath of a family member, a spouse, a boyfriend, a girlfriend, a loved one, someone who deeply, deeply cares about us or we care about them. And oftentimes, we can be so cruel to each other. So cruel to each other in a way that maybe we aren't to other people. I can't tell you how often this comes up weekly. I don't want to say daily, but weekly. This issue is coming in. Why is she, why is he so mean to me? I don't get it. Everyone else thinks he's a nice guy. Work thinks he's great. His friends think he's awesome. But he is so cruel to me. Or she goes out with her friends, no problem. No one would have any idea that she unloads on me the way that she does. Why does this happen? Why do we feel like we can unload on our family members? And really, if you'll recall, we've talked about this analogy before here on The Healthy Mind, this analogy of road rage, right? Someone's driving down the road, maybe it's you, and you cut in front of a person. You're not thinking. You figure you've got enough room, and you cut them off. And all of a sudden, they're honking their horn, maybe flipping you off, maybe drive up next to you and are screaming at you. Whoa. Now, we've known that that has happened. There's been reports where people have literally killed each other over road rage. And the question is, who is that person really mad at? Who is it? Is it really that person who cut in front of them 10 feet too close rather than 20 feet more distance? Or was that just the last straw? Now, granted, most episodes of road rage don't end up in violence, but people unload. And really, it isn't really about the traffic issue. It's really about safety. Yeah, safety. Safety in the sense that people are carrying a lot of anger or frustration or anxiety, and there's a trigger, boom, someone cuts in front of you, and it sets off a cascade of anger. And because you're in a steel box going about 60 miles an hour, car, and another person is in a steel box going about the same speed, you're not going to stop and get out. It's safe. You're protected in your cocoon where you can let loose on that person, kind of metaphorically, in your car. There's a safety there. There's very little chance that something bad is going to happen. We're not really getting angry at that person who cut in front of us. We're getting angry through that person. It's kind of like the canvas, and we paint our emotions onto that person. I can't believe that you cut me off. How can you do that? And so on. Now, why do I use the analogy of road rage when I'm talking about family conflict? We do this to our families in the same way. Part of the reason that family tends to receive, or those that we love tend to receive, the brunt of our emotions, the negative ones, anger, irritability, sadness, anxiety, it's because it is a safe place to do so. Now, don't get me wrong here. I am not justifying this or rationalizing it or saying that it's acceptable. I'm just trying to give a bit of a psychological context as to why this can happen. Why all too often we can really, really hurt the ones that we love the most. Think about it. You can't unload at work. Start getting angry and yelling. There's too much on the line. You could lose your job, and then you don't have an income, or you don't have a career anymore. You really can't do it with your friends, maybe some of your good friends, but you really can't unload on them or acquaintances or neighbors because they'll never pay attention to you anymore. They'll avoid you, or they'll simply go away. They don't need your baggage. But the bottom line is, there are consequences there to unloading on friends and acquaintances. Now, in family, there are consequences. Don't get me wrong. The person who is receiving all this venom, all this anger, is affected terribly. I see it every week. But to the person who's releasing the anger, there's less of a chance that that person is going away. They're family. They love me. They're not going to go anywhere, or at least less likely to go away. So this is why, at least part of the reason, we hurt the ones we love so much. And as I always try to tell people, at least to understand, maybe not in the moment because we're emotional. We know how we feel when we're being stressed and someone's yelling at us or being critical or being anxious or being depressed, and we can't take it. It's hard. It's very hard to think logically and calmly in that moment. But afterwards, it is important, like the road rage analogy, to understand that person isn't necessarily yelling or throwing that anger at you, getting angry at you, but they're getting angry through you. If you can picture yourself as a white canvas, and that person who's angry, your family member or loved one who is yelling and screaming, those emotions or those words coming out as paint, that is the analogy I want you to look at. They are painting you with their emotion. You are the trigger, whether you realized it or not. And people unleash their emotions onto each other. And usually family. Why? Because there's less of a consequence. It is safer. There's a million other reasons why things happen, and I'm not trying to simplify it just down to this issue. Family is safe, less of a consequence. This is why people get angry. But it is important because this is happening as well. And it's important for that loved one, that family member who's receiving all of that negative emotion, maybe not in the moment, but afterwards, to understand what is going on so that you, that we don't own that anger. If you've done something wrong and there's a reason for someone to be angry, that's a whole other issue. But if it seems like it comes out of left field, like you can't do anything right, like you can't say anything without someone reacting negatively, probably less about you and more about that individual, that person. So you give yourself that kindness and that compassion that it's not something that is happening because you did anything wrong. These are complex relationships, and we are so incredibly powerful in the way that we assess danger and threat and safety and consequence. All in a split second, in a microsecond, and then we react. But yet, on the receiving end, all we feel is that negative energy. And if there is a vulnerability, an insecurity, something that we don't feel so good about within ourselves, anger and emotion that is directed in that way can be tremendously hurtful. And it's not something that easily goes away. So when I talk to individuals, I want them to understand part of what is going on here, the canvas, painting those emotions. Someone is not getting angry at you. They're getting angry through you. So important to understand. It gives us a little bit of a break. It isn't that we are to blame when we're not to blame. And that can help. That can empower us, and it can move us towards health. And when we begin to do that, we can help make changes in our relationships for the better. Things can get better. We are all capable of changing. You are too. No matter how you doubt it at this very moment, you are too. And when you see it, oh, it is a wonderful, wonderful step that you have taken down your road to the healthy mind. And now, it's time for news. Okay, well, a very, very busy couple of weeks in health news. The first story that I wanted to cover, I just found it fascinating, this idea of depression and the possibility that it could be contagious. Oh, yes, you heard that right. Contagious. The headline is Depression Contagious. And what this particular study looked at was what is the possibility that people can transmit a bad mood that they're feeling onto others. And I guess intuitively, we felt that before when we've been around people who maybe feel low or feel down. And maybe we start to own some of that, right? We just don't like the way people make us feel. We feel depressed around them and the like. Well, scientists, scientists at the University of Notre Dame wanted to look at this particular phenomenon. And what they found was that, at least in college roommates, that there's a particular style of thinking that makes people vulnerable to depression, and that can actually rub off on others, increasing their symptoms of depression, not just in the moment, but up to 6 months later. Really fascinating. Now, the important thing to focus here on is a term known as cognitive vulnerability, and we'll get to that in just a second. But we know that people who respond negatively to stressful life events, interpreting these events like they can't change them and they're at fault or it's a part of their weakness or their character, are more vulnerable to depression. And what this is called is cognitive vulnerability, the fact that the way that you think about how things happen to you really makes a difference in the way and your vulnerability for depression. So this cognitive vulnerability, that kind of feeling, is such a potent risk factor for depression that it can be used to predict which individuals are likely to experience depression in the future, even, and this is the most important part, even if they've never had a depressive episode before. Now, how does this cognitive vulnerability form? Scientists are only starting to study this now, but these individual differences in cognitive vulnerability seem to really take hold in adolescence, and really what happens is it remains stable throughout adulthood. So what these researchers wondered was, could this cognitive vulnerability be, for lack of a better word, contagious during major life transitions? So, what better place to study this than in college freshmen? Major life transition, they've got roommates. So what they did was they studied pairs of roommates as they're going through the transition of living on their own in college. So within a month of arriving on campus, these roommates completed questionnaires. They tested them for their cognitive vulnerability and then did the same measures both at 3 and 6 months later. And they also measured the stressful life events at the two time points as well. So they get an idea. Were there stressful life events? How did they deal with it? And what role did this cognitive vulnerability play in the depression? And what the scientists found was that the freshmen who were assigned to roommates who had this cognitive vulnerability, the high levels, they tended to interpret these negative events in a bad way. Well, they were more likely to catch their roommates' cognitive style and develop high levels of cognitive vulnerability themselves. And this contagion effect was still present both 3 and 6 months later. So, okay, you're thinking, well, that's a neat study, kind of interesting that they did this, but here is the ominous part. The changes in cognitive vulnerability for those individuals that had that negative roommate affected their risk for future depressive symptoms. The students that showed an increase in cognitive vulnerability in the first 3 months of college had nearly twice the level of depressive symptoms at 6 months than those that didn't show the increase. I mean, this is pretty amazing evidence for this idea of contagion, that someone's negative feelings and outlooks can be passed on to us. We feel it. But then it isn't just that we feel it. It increases our risk significantly for depression on down the line, even if we've never had depression before. Amazing. Now, it isn't all bad. Like the researchers pointed out, there's so much wealth that can be taken from this study. In fact, you can think about how you can utilize this fact to the positive. If the negative impact, those that feel negative can have that contagion passed on to others, putting those who are already depressed around positive people, happy people, may have a therapeutic effect. And this is what the researchers suggested. Perhaps placing people in positive environments, positive social environments, may enhance therapy or perhaps even replace it. And the really hopeful thing here that the researchers noted was, look, this cognitive vulnerability, it has the potential to wax and wane. And it shouldn't be seen as something that is static and unchangeable. It is flexible and it can be adjusted. It can be molded. So it isn't all bad. Some really interesting research there looking at the possibility that depression could be contagious. Okay, now we've talked quite a bit, and I will continue to talk about it quite a bit on The Healthy Mind, the role of omega-3 fatty acids, fish oils, and foods containing these fatty acids. The research that's been done over the years to show very, very potent anti-inflammatory effects and good data, at least in my universe, that shows that fish oils and omega-3 fatty acids may, in fact, help depression. Because for some people, depression may be an inflammatory event. Well, there's new evidence about the healthful benefits of omega-3 fatty acids. The headline, omega-3 fatty acids are linked to preserving memory. Scientists at the University of Alabama at Birmingham and the University of Athens, Greece, have found that people who closely follow a Mediterranean diet were significantly less likely to develop problems with their thinking and their memory skills. They found that individuals who eat foods that contain a lot of these omega-3 fatty acids, this would be things like fish and chicken and salad dressing, while at the same time avoiding saturated fats like meat and dairy foods, that may have a very, very positive effect in preserving our memory and our ability to think. Now, according to one of the lead researchers, Dr. George Chavouglis, with the University of Alabama and also the University of Athens, quote, since there are no definitive treatments for most dementing illnesses, modifiable activities such as diet that may delay the onset of dementia are very important. Now, this was a pretty large study. Information was gathered from over 17,000 people, about an average age of 64 years old, to see how well they maintained a Mediterranean diet. And they were given tests that measured both memory and our thinking ability over the next 4 years. What did they find? Those individuals that stuck to that Mediterranean diet, committed to it, were 19% less likely to develop problems with their thinking and their memory. Amazing. Now, Dr. Tsivgulis was quick to point out diet is one of the major, major factors, but you have to avoid obesity. Don't smoke. Make sure you're taking medications as you need them to control all of your health issues as well. But diet is something that is modifiable. You have an input. You can make a difference there. And at least here, like other parts of our health, the omega-3 fatty acids have a significant impact in this study as it relates to our memory and our thinking. The power of the omega-3s. We are going to continue to have this conversation here on The Healthy Mind about the amazing power of omega-3s. Okay. With the time that we have left, I just want to blast through the rest of the news in a segment I like to call the Healthy Mind Headlines. Okay, the first headline. Poor parenting, including overprotection, increases bullying risk. Children who are exposed to negative parenting, including abuse, neglect, but also overprotection, are more likely to experience childhood bullying by their peers, according to a new analysis of more than 200,000 children. The next headline. Reading wordless storybooks to toddlers may expose them to richer language. researchers at the University of Waterloo have found that children hear more complex language from parents when they read a storybook with only pictures compared to a picture vocabulary book. And finally, oh, I love this one. Clenching your right fist may give a better grip on memory. Oh, yeah. Clenching your right hand may help form a stronger memory of an event or action, and clenching your left hand may help you recollect the memory later, according to new research from Montclair State University. So, if you want to remember something, squeeze that right hand. It just might make the difference. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that is going to just about do it for this week's podcast. Thank you so much for taking time out of your day to listen to the show. I really do appreciate it. I ask you a kindness, if you do enjoy The Healthy Mind, if you could take a second, if you're listening to it on iTunes, and please rate the podcast for me. You have no idea what just a few ratings can do to the show. I would really, really appreciate it. The website, as always, www.thehealthymind.com. You can email me at any time. That's peter@thehealthymind.com. That's peter@thehealthymind.com. And for the Healthy Mind Podcast, part of the Healthy Mind Network, I'm Dr. Peter Zafiridis. Have a great week, everybody, and I'll see you next time right here on the Healthy Mind.